KCSU-FM Stamford, welcome to another edition and the first edition of the fall quarter 2012 of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society. I'm excited to start off the quarter today with a returning guest, my predecessor at the Center for Internet and Society as a fellow, now a professor at the University of Virginia Law School, Chris Sprigman, a co-author along with Cal Rostiala of the book The Knockoff Economy, How Imitation Sparks Innovation. We have had on Hearsay Culture over the last six-plus years occasional guests that have taken on the issue of copying per se. And while we've had many discussions regarding the contours of copyright law, we have rarely, although we have had conversations regarding whether in fact copying itself is beneficial. And so a couple of guests over the last few years have focused on this area. Professor Odit Shankar of Ohio State, who wrote a terrific book a few years ago called Copycats, spent quite a bit of time discussing how the benefits of copying from a business and management perspective. We've also had on Professor Marcus Boone, who wrote a terrific book on copying from the perspective of Buddhism, and Marcus's view boiled down to, and I always hate to boil down the views of people that are thinking deeply about these issues, but that copying is good because it fits the human nature and the human condition. It's something that we do naturally. And so Chris and his co-author Cal, who is not joining us today, focus on the issue and the question of copying from a traditional IP perspective, from the standpoint of asking whether, in fact, copying fulfills the utilitarian objective of intellectual property law, that is, that idea that we want to incentivize the creation of new works by allowing authors get a return on their investment. But Chris's book, The Knockoff Economy, doesn't just focus on copyright law. It also focuses on patent law and more broadly on the question of what we're doing with IP in prohibiting copying across the board. And so in The Knockoff Economy, Chris builds on a number of articles that he and his co-authors have worked on as well as an extensive amount of research to look at several industries that are not often the focus of intellectual property scholars, but the industries that in fact do not use even perhaps any intellectual property regime per se, but at most use norms, and in that way don't enforce the primary right that authors and copyright get, which is the right to prevent copying of their work by others. And so Chris and Cal take a look at industries like the comedy industry, as well as the fashion industry, the food industry, and even sports, and some others, and draw some very interesting conclusions about these particular niche areas, all of which do not enforce copyright, or don't even enforce, again, any traditional form of intellectual property law. And yet all of these industries, as Chris and Cal point out, are thriving in their own way. And so in the book and our focus today, we're going to take a close look at this critique that Cal and Chris have articulated in Knockoff Economy, a book which, while it does have a good dose of law, and it is written from the perspective of two scholars who are writing, I think, to a broader audience. And in that way, I think there's a lot of information there that would be of interest, not just to intellectual property geeks like me and like listeners of this show, not just to technology geeks who are also like me and listeners of this show, but a broader community of people thinking about innovation in a modern economy and on the rules for innovation. And so in The Knockoff Economy and in discussion today, we're going to have a pretty wide-ranging discussion and drill down on some industries that rarely get much attention from scholars. Chris, by way of background, teaches IP law, antitrust, competition policy, and comparative constitutional law at the University of Virginia. He received his BA from the University of Pennsylvania. He attended Chicago Law. He also clerk for Judge Stephen Reinhardt on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and for Justice Lawrence Ackerman of the Constitutional Court of South Africa. He has been with the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. He has also been, as I mentioned, an active scholar in the field, including his work at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford. Chris is someone that I've known for quite a while, and I consider a friend. But that, with that notwithstanding, The Knockoff Economy is a book that I want to get into up front because there's a lot to talk about in a short amount of time. Chris is joining us from his home via Skype in Charlottesville, Virginia. Chris, thanks for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.
Let's start off with a question that I've asked you before, but certainly asked most authors, which is literally, why write the book? Why did you become interested in this topic?
Well, so Cal and I are interested in intellectual property, but really not primarily. What we're interested in most is innovation and creativity. We're interested in IP as one of the ways in which the law tries to get more innovation and creativity. The typical justification for IP is that it will serve these property rights to induce people to engage in creative labor by preventing copyists from siphoning off some of the returns to creative labor. And that makes a lot of sense at a general level. But, you know, when Cal and I started looking out into the world, we noticed that there were a bunch of creative industries, some very important ones, like fashion or food or financial innovations, where the theory didn't really seem to work all that well. I mean, fashion, for example, very little copyright protection, very little patent protection. For fashion designs, tons and tons of innovation and creativity. So Cal and I wanted to just go out into the world and take a look around at a more micro level, at these industries that created without copyright or without patent, try to figure out how they worked. And we hoped that would give us some understanding of how industries like music or film or commercial publishing that depend very heavily on IP protections might be able better in the future to deal with a world in which copying is going to get easier and easier and harder to stop. So that's why we wrote the book.
And you know, it's interesting, because and you say it up front, and I do want to get into it later on, is what lessons can be taken by larger industries in terms of volume and sales, and also in terms of, as you point out in the book, research and development costs like music and pharma. But before we get there, let's define a few terms up front. You use the word knockoff. I think most people might know what that means, but I always want to be certain. How do you define a knockoff?
So it depends on what industry you're talking about. So in fashion, a knockoff is a dress or a garment that looks like something that already exists in the marketplace. So Oscar de la Renta has a new cocktail dress, and maybe Forever 21 knocks it off, right? They put out a very similar-looking cocktail dress. In music, knockoffs are different. So cover songs are knockoffs in the music world. John Coltrane knocks off Rodgers and Hammerstein, and he puts out a jazz version of My Favorite Things. And of course, it's very different, but it's recognizably taking inspiration from the original composition. It's a knockoff. It just so happens in music, for reasons that are interesting, historical reasons, that knockoff is perfectly legal, but it's a knockoff nonetheless.
And so when we say knockoff, we're not just talking about a pure copy verbatim, right? I mean, the knockoff that, you know, we think of, and certainly in my experience, having practiced in IP for a number of years, you know, you have a logo for let's say, a piece of clothing, and someone takes the same exact logo and puts it on a garment that isn't, in fact, created by the entity who owns the logo. You're also talking about copying that might, and I do want to use some legal jargon up front, might be transformative in a sense, might create a new work of authorship, might be slightly different than the original?
Yeah, so let's be clear. People in the industry, so the fashion industry, just take that one. They use words a little bit inconsistently. So there are counterfeits. There are, so for example, Louis Vuitton handbags that aren't really Louis Vuitton handbags. They're fakes. Those are counterfeits. They use the Louis Vuitton mark. Those are not legal. Those are illegal. You can go to jail for those. On the other hand, there are knockoffs. There are Louis Vuitton bags that look like Louis Vuitton bags, but they're not marked as Louis Vuitton bags. They're marked as something else. Those are knockoffs. Those are not, for the most part, illegal. As long as you don't take a protected trademark, you can mimic most often in the fashion industry the shape, the design of a garment or an accessory perfectly legally. In terms of the copying that's involved, sometimes the copying is very precise. So Forever 21 very closely copies the Diane von Furstenberg dress. But sometimes, and actually more often, the copying is recognizable. That is, some popular design is knocked off, but the knockoff artist does something different with it. Christian Louboutin's platform pumps were popular a few years ago, but it was a big trend in them. There were tons and tons of knockoffs of those platform pumps, but, you know, the knockoffs weren't just people copying them point for point. There were lots and lots of variations, lots of different platform pumps that Louboutin itself probably never would have put out, but other companies did. This is knocking off too. It's just knocking off that doesn't exactly copy. It takes inspiration for some new piece of creativity, and that's important.
Now let's, with that definition, and again, I mean, your subtitle gets into it, how imitation sparks innovation. Let's start off, for those that don't focus heavily on either IP, or as you point out, more broadly on innovation policy. Describe, if you will, the conventional wisdom on copying. What's taught not only in law schools, but in business schools about copying?
So the conventional wisdom is that copying is a real threat to creativity, that copying is, in fact, potentially the death of creativity. And why is that? Because creativity is often very expensive. Copying is often very cheap. So who's going to pour a lot of resources into creating something new if others can just come along and copy it? The copyists will not have spent the money, the time, the effort to create in the first place, but they'll be in competition with the creator. They'll siphon away a lot of the returns that the creator could have gotten for his or her creativity. So copying is seen as a threat. Why do we have IP? We have an IP law to eliminate that threat, or at least to limit it, by preventing a whole bunch of this copying, right? So that's the conventional wisdom that we wanted to explore in the book.
And to focus a little more specifically on this idea of copying, the notion, at least the traditional notion of copying, is that the act of copying is not just going to potentially usurp the value that the original author might come up with, but also there are theories that don't have a lot of currency here in the United States but have currency elsewhere, although I'm going to ask you whether I'm being accurate about this or fair, involving things like taking something that's mine, violating my personhood as an idea, or stealing my labor. How much of that idea do you think flows through, even though it's not the stated policy for things like intellectual property law? How much of that in your research do you think actually flows through the general condemnation of copying that we see?
Yeah, so, you know, I have kids, and one thing I noticed when my kids were very little is that one of the worst insults one could hurl at the other was that he or she was a copycat, right? So we have deep intuitive feelings about copying, that it's wrong. And I actually think in a lot of ways our intuition misleads us. So let me get to you have this specific question about, you know, why do we ban copying? Well, we have these deontic theories, right? We have these rights-based theories that tell us that copying is bad. So I have the beginnings of a paper on this. I've been thinking about this for a long time. In America, we hew to a very different theory. We hew to a utilitarian theory. It's the one I laid out, that we stop copying for practical reasons. We think it's going to interfere with creativity. The book really takes that theory on and says, well, the theory is sometimes true. It's sometimes not. It depends on the context. But then over in Europe, if you talk to people about, you know, why they have laws against copying, they typically don't tell that utilitarian story, or at least they don't tell it first. They tell stories about, well, I worked on this. I put my labor into this creativity. You don't have any right to take it. That's a labor theory. John Locke really is responsible for that. People adapted Locke's ideas into a labor theory of IP. Or they'll say something like, well, my creativity reflects my personality, and, you know, allowing you to just copy my creativity invades my personal autonomy. So this is a kind of liberal personality theory-based theory of IP. It comes from Hegel or Kant, depending on what strand of it you look at. I actually don't have a ton of respect for these theories, frankly. I think that they both provide adequate justifications at the very highest level for why we might have some rules against copying. But once you try to apply them, once, for example, you try to construct an actual working IP system based on the insights of these theories, I think they break down. They're not very useful. And what you resort to is you resort to interest balancing, which is basically indistinguishable from what the utilitarian theory does. So I think ultimately these labor theories or these personality theories are parasitic on the utilitarian theory. I don't think they actually do any work in the world that the utilitarian theory doesn't do. And so I don't actually ultimately think they're important at all.
Are they, even if they're theoretically questionable, do you think that there is enough, that the issue, that the view has enough currency even in the U.S. that it adds an additional patina of condemnation even here among, and I want to be clear, among the industries that have most challenged any lessening or loosening of rights and copyrights? I am obviously thinking of industries like the entertainment industry, of pharma. I have, in my experience, seen quite a few conversations that start bleeding into this idea of personhood. And I'm curious whether even if the theory, in your view, isn't very sound, whether it is nonetheless operating under the surface.
So the personality theory or the labor theory as a theory, I think it has very little role to play. I think as an intuition, and this is what I mean, I don't think very many people who think about copying really think about it in as a kind of moral philosopher would, by putting together, you know, these theories and trying to justify them. I think when many people approach these arguments, they do so through their intuition, not through any real deep acquaintance with the theory. And, you know, I think our intuitions can be helpful, but I think in this case our intuitions are really misleading. So I think that copying often sparks creativity, often is productive of creativity, is often the way that we actually approach creativity. And, you know, that's what the book is really about. It's not a direct attack on these non-utilitarian theories, in part because, you know, that's a whole other book and a book that would be very different to read. But it is by implication, I think, an attack on the fundaments of those theories, which take copying essentially to be harmful to some important interest.
We're chatting with Professor Chris Sprigman of Virginia Law, co-author of the book The Knockoff Economy with Cal Rustiello. Chris, let me ask you one more kind of precursor type question before we get into some of the points you make in the book. With regard to, and I think it's important to understand it, with regard to the interaction between copying and competition, how do they work in tandem? How do they oppose each other?
Well, if you think of IP laws, what are they really about? IP laws are about limiting competition. So absent copyright or absent patent, we'd have a lot of people copying other people's innovations, and the copyist would be in competition with the innovator. You know, we have copyright and patent law essentially to limit that competition, which is a little bit uncomfortable because, you know, the basis of a free market economy, certainly the basis of our free market economy, is competition. Right now, you might decide that, well, we don't like this competition that comes from copyists. The whole point of the knockoff economy is that we should like it a lot more than we do. That actually competition that comes from copyists is often not only good for consumers, but really good for creativity. So we point to all these case studies where we think that's true.
And let's get into those now, because I think it's interesting. You've identified, and I mentioned in the introduction, several of the industries, if you will, that you focused on. How did you identify them, and what characteristics were you looking for in focusing on these industries?
Back in 2005, with the fashion industry, we published a paper in 2006 on this. So the fashion industry is absolutely enormous. It's $200 billion a year in commerce just in the States. It dwarfs the music industry. It dwarfs the film industry. So this industry runs basically not on the logic of the IP system. It runs on a different logic. So it's never been illegal in the United States to copy fashion designs. Fashion designs are, for the most part, free to copy. If you go to the mall, you see that in action, right? So every season, you see new designs come out, and you see them widely copied. Some of the copying, as I mentioned before, is exact copying. A lot of it isn't. A lot of the copying is the appropriation of a recognizable design, a popular design, and then some new creativity added. But, you know, copyright law, if it applied, would ban that too. That would be a derivative work. So you don't have copyright law. You have all this copying. Turns out the fashion industry is pretty consistently profitable, growing, thriving, competitive, innovative. And why is that? Cal and I figured out, after we'd looked a little bit and thought about this, that copying actually really helps the fashion industry do its work. So every year new designs come out, every season actually new designs come out, they're widely copied. When a design is popular enough, appealing enough to be widely copied, we recognize it as part of a trend. Copying makes trends, and trends sell fashion, right? So the change in trends, what causes a lot of people to go out and buy clothes, not that their clothes are wearing out, but that their clothes are falling out of style. And, you know, Shakespeare observed this hundreds of years ago when he said that the style wears out more apparel than the man, right? So we buy a lot more clothes because of the change in style. Copying helps to set these trends that we recognize, and then copying helps to kill the trends. So in other words, once a trend is copied too widely and becomes too ubiquitous, the fashion forward among us, the fashionistas, say, well, you know, this is overdone. I'm going to jump off. And at the time they jump off, there's a new trend bubbling up that's waiting for them. Copying is helping to set that trend. So copying sets trends, copying kills trends. Trends sell fashion. And, you know, our conclusion, and I think we're not the only ones that have observed this now, our conclusion is that copying is the fuel that runs the fashion cycle, that the fashion industry would be poorer and would be less creative without copying.
And so you also focus on, and again, to be clear, what I was thinking small, I was thinking in terms of something you point out in the book about the upfront costs in creation. You also mentioned comedy and even sports, but let's focus on comedy for a moment, because there you're dealing with oral traditions of sorts. You're dealing with stand-up performers. You mentioned in the book, and I want to get into the details on some of these, but you mentioned a very interesting story involving the comedian Louis C.K. and the comedian Dane Cook, which was dramatized to some degree on Louis C.K.'s own show on FX. Tell that story, if you would, and again, from that perspective, why comedy as an industry is an instructive one for us.
So comedy, what stand-up comedians often worry about is rivals stealing their jokes, right? And this is what's at issue in the Louis C.K. Dane Cook incident. So for years now, Dane Cook has been accused of stealing jokes from a bunch of people, including Louis C.K. There are three jokes on a Dane Cook album that sound remarkably like jokes on an earlier Louis C.K. comedy album. And this has resulted in a lot of people saying a lot of really pretty nasty things about Dane Cook. Louis C.K. hasn't said anything, but recently Dane Cook appeared on an episode of Louis C.K.'s show, Louis, which is on FX. The plot is that Louis wants some concert tickets for Lady Gaga that he wants to give to his daughter for her birthday. And Dane Cook shares a promoter with Lady Gaga. So Louis goes to a Dane Cook show and meets with him in his dressing room prior to the show to ask Dane Cook if he'll get tickets, help him get tickets for his daughter. And, you know, Dane Cook is pretty offended that Louis is even making this request, because, you know, there's all these accusations about Dane Cook stealing the jokes, and Dane Cook says, I didn't steal the jokes. And Louis C.K. basically says, actually, I think you did, right? And they proceed to have it out, you know, on this sitcom. They have an argument about what happened. Neither of them really win the argument, but what's going on there is a version of what goes on in the comedy world a lot, which is, you know, comedians worry about rivals stealing their jokes, but when that happens, they do not file copyright lawsuits, right? There are none, really, that we could find. No cases of comics suing other comics over a joke. And there's good reason for that. So, you know, copyright law doesn't cover jokes very well. Funny ideas are not copyrightable, only the particular way you tell them is. So someone can take your funny idea, tell it in a different way, escape copyright liability. Copyright's not a particularly good tool. Comedians don't use it, but they are concerned about maintaining some form of property rights in their material. So what do they do? they have essentially a set of community norms, right? Comedians as a profession have anti-stealing norms, which in some ways are similar to copyright, in some ways are actually quite different. Dotan Oliar, my colleague and I at University of Virginia, we described in a paper that we did on stand-up comedians, and Dotan and I described these norms, and then we described how comedians enforce these norms on one another. So enforcement's a community job. They watch each other in comedy clubs. When they detect stealing, they report and they take action. So they badmouth comics they think are thieves, and, you know, badmouthing may not sound so bad, but if you think about it for a minute, comedians are excellent typically at badmouthing. Mm-hmm. So it can be a pretty painful sanction. Badmouthing doesn't work. They'll refuse to appear on a comedy bill with the person they think is a thief, and that can be a real impediment to getting jobs. And if worse comes to worst, occasionally comedians will punch each other in the mouth over a stolen joke. You know, not something that Ron and I really admire, but nonetheless it happens. And this is a form of kind of informal sanctions that deter most joke stealing. So comedians don't resort to copyright, but they have informal rules that essentially do some of that job.
So is your, you know, with those two examples, and I'll ask you one more question before we get into break, is your goal in the book to cause the reader to question or merely question the you know, the assumption that copying is all bad, or do you have greater aspirations, if you will, in terms of your skepticism about the IP system and its relative import, or even necessity, to allow innovation to thrive?
Well, I think there's a couple of messages in the book. One is that, you know, the IP system acts as if all creative industries are alike, and actually they're very different. In fact, copying is actually not only good, I think it's necessary. I think a certain amount of copying is just essential to the fashion industry functioning. And so to impose the normal rules of copyright on the fashion industry would be a complete disaster. We shouldn't do it. And there are people out there arguing that we should. Those people are wrong. The message of the book is that, you know, let's not go there. With respect to comedy, the lesson there is, you know, even in the absence of a functioning IP system, industries have a way, right? Often norms can step in where law is missing. And norms can do a pretty good job at controlling copying. So if creators are worried about copying, they have options other than resort to the law. So just because you have a concern about copying doesn't mean you should have an automatic resort to the law. There may be ways you can structure the industry that help control copying. You know, and the payoff in the end, I think, of the book is, you know, just realistically, we're living in a world where copying is getting easier, harder to control. Does that mean that creativity is going to die? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Creativity is going to change. Creative industries are going to adapt. And we think that the industries that already thrive without copyright and patent show them ways to adapt that are viable, we think, over the long term.
We're chatting with Professor Chris Sprigman, co-author of the book The Knockoff Economy, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU, which is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you keep listening to the show. So Chris, let me ask you that, I want to be absolutely clear about this for the listeners, because there has been a run of at least several books, over the last, I'd say 3 or 4 years that make the basic argument that, copyright law and patent law for that matter, which we haven't focused on much, in our discussion thus far, should just be abandoned outright. David K. Levine and Michele Broldrin wrote a book not too long ago called Against Intellectual Monopoly, making an economic argument for it. There have been others. But I want to be clear on your position. Is your view that, as a general matter, that, and you said that it's industry specific, but to be clear, even in those industries where copying is allowed, allowed or where norms are used as opposed to law. Are you suggesting in the book, or do you suggest, that IP law in those industries should be abandoned? In other words, that those in those industries shouldn't even have the possibility of bringing a copyright infringement action or a patent infringement action?
So the main message of the book is stop thinking at a 30,000-foot level and start looking at individual industries. So we certainly don't say that copyright and patent law should be abolished across the board, and we don't say that they should be abolished within any particular industry. But focus on particular industries, because that's the message of the book. So in the fashion industry, there are proposals to extend copyright to fashion. We think they're a mistake. Existed in the United States outside of the copyright system forever. It's done extremely well. There's no problem fixed. A fix is likely to create problems. It's a bad idea. So don't extend copyright to fashion. That's one takeaway. With respect to some of these other industries, so the music industry, for example, you could keep ratcheting up copyright protection for the music industry, and in fact, you know, there are proposals to continue to do that. So there are proposals to mandate three strikes. There are lots of proposals to continually strengthen copyright for the music industry. We just think that, for the most part, that's going to be throwing good resources after bad. That is not primarily the way to handle the problem of piracy in the music industry. There are lots of ways the music industry can adapt to make its business model more resistant to piracy. We talk a lot about that in the book, at the end of the book. You know, again, our main message is not we should abolish patent or copyright. Our main message is that there are ways other than patent and copyright to make creativity coexist and even benefit from copying.
With regard to those issues, and let's drill down a little bit further on let's say the music industry, but also pharma. You know, we've seen over the last year a run of policy efforts, right? The Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act. Late last year, we have a current negotiation going on at the international level called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is being done largely in secret. But which will purport to extend, I think, a fair amount of U.S. Copyright ideas abroad, as well as patents. All of these, you know, efforts are designed to address, at least theoretically, address head-on the fact that piracy exists and that, therefore, there is lost revenue. And with regard to those lessons that you draw from, based upon your analysis of these other industries, what would you expect or want the music industry to think carefully about, for example, based upon those six ideas or lessons that you you mentioned in the book? So you can talk about those six lessons, and if you would tie them to the music industry, that would allow for further discussion there.
Yeah, so what's going on in music is the record labels' revenues are declining, right? So since the advent of Napster, record label revenues are down about 60% or so, adjusted for inflation. But music as an art form is thriving. So the production of music, the distribution of music, its live performance, all of these parts of the music industry are thriving. So what do I think is the public policy takeaway? I think the music industry isn't dying. The music industry is changing. The business models that the major record labels have relied upon for a long time are becoming less and less viable in the face of piracy. This isn't to say that piracy is good. It's bad. But like any kind of social problem, you know, there are not unlimited resources to address it. And when I look at the efforts like SOPA and PIPA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership and this idea of, you know, cable companies getting together with record labels and movie studios to cut off internet access to people who are found to be habitual downloaders or uploaders, I actually think these are unlikely to work in the long term. They're going to be very expensive, and then just going to distract the industry from more productive strategies, I think, of dealing with piracy. So what are the more productive strategies? I mean, just take the music industry. So as the recording becomes less and less the focus of the music industry's business model, the live show rises to take its place. It just so happens that the way the industry is structured, the record companies don't really have much of an interest in the live performance part of the industry, but that's kind of an accident, right? So as the record industries shrink, the live music part of the industry grows, You know, it's one end of the balloon gets squeezed, another end of the balloon pops out. It's much more difficult to copy a live performance. It's hard to pirate a live performance because there are lots of elements of the live performance that are not replicable in a pirated copy of a concert. The live performance is just much more resistant to piracy. What the music industry has been, you know, over its existence, is really only a window of about 25 years or so where people made a lot of money off of records. The music industry was about live performance before the record industry became the focus of the music industry, and it's going to be about live performance after the record industry recedes in importance. So this is not a terrible problem. This is a problem for the record companies, but it's not necessarily a problem for the rest of us. That's worth a whole lot of public resources being poured into it.
And so that, you know, and so to give the pushback position, and I, you know, having had this discussion with a number of industry representatives, one of the arguments they make, which goes directly back into this question of money and resources necessary to create new works, is that if you allow copying, the revenue that would be lost, or that is lost, by the copy is not being reinvested in the creation of new works. So it's kind of a pay-as-you-go system. The revenue, and this issue, of course, comes up in the context of copyright duration, right? Why do you need term of life plus 70? Well, because the work in that's still generating royalties from 1938 is funding the creation of new works in 2012. How do you respond to that argument?
Yeah, I think that argument misses a couple of very basic developments of the last 15 years or so that have, you know, kind of changed the universe for musicians. So it used to be very expensive to produce music, right back in the day when recording was expensive. Now it's very cheap to produce music. Digital recording platforms are cheap, plentiful. It's really easy to record a high quality recording for much less money than it used to cost. Distribution of music used to be expensive, but the record industries would print up ones and zeros on little plastic discs. They would load up trucks and they would then drive stores, which most importantly had very limited shelf space. So the fruits of that expensive production and distribution model were a few superstars who made a lot of money, a large number of broke nobodies, and intermediaries, the record companies, were the key to the whole thing. But that's just not the world anymore, right? Production is relatively cheap. Distribution is relatively cheap. Communication between artists and their fans is much, much easier today without intermediaries than it was 20 years ago before we got the internet. Social media, right, makes it much easier for musicians to communicate with their fans. And in the cost structure, the low cost structure that we have today, it's much easier for musicians to carve out a sustainable career on, you know, smaller scale, right? So do we need the enormous amount of capital that we used to need to fund artists' careers? No, not, it's not the same, right? It's cheaper. And in this world, high-cost intermediaries just aren't well adapted to survive. So no, I don't think that copying has the same effect in today's world that it had in the pre-internet world. I think, you know, we could say that copying can often serve as an advertisement for the quality of a recording. It can be the inducement that gets someone to come to the live show. It can be the inducement that gets someone to become more than a casual fan of an artist. And once you're more than a casual fan and you're connected to the artist, you're more likely to actually buy rather than steal. There are lots of ways that artists can have viable careers today. It's just a way that doesn't necessarily include the record company as the key player.
We're chatting with Professor Chris Sprigman of Virginia, law school co-author of the book The Knockoff Economy with Cal Rustiello. So Chris, I'll come back to that question that I asked a short while ago. So with regard to those lessons, those patterns, those trends that you identified towards the end of the book, what do you say, or what would you say, to a representative of the RIAA or the MPAA for that matter, as far as lessons? What conditions, could exist in the music industry or the film industry that would make copying beneficial?
Yeah, let me make one thing clear. I'm not really talking to the RIAA because do I think that record companies, the labels that are the member firms of the RIAA, are going to be at the center of the music industry in the future? No, I don't. right? Industries change. They rise and different parts of industries are prominent depending on what the industry's overall business model is. I just think the record companies are no longer going to be at the center of the record industry. You know, but in terms of music as an art form, what lessons does the book have for that? Well, I think, you know, musicians are adapting even as we speak. So, you know, emphasis is returning to the live show. More artist revenues are coming from the live show than used to come in the past, right? Emphasis is returning to communication with fans. So social media, digital platforms, they facilitate this. And in a musical market where there's more and more choice, and of course there's more and more choice because now, you know, the internet has essentially unlimited shelf space. And so because there's not this limitation on availability, and because there is better communication about what's out there, people find what they like better. There's more choice. And when there's more choice, there's more market fragmentation. There's smaller audiences for each musician, more musicians. These smaller audiences are more connected to the bands that they like. These are the conditions under which social norms can start to have their regulatory effect. These are the conditions under which social norms can be used to shape consumer decisions in a way that leads to more buying and less stealing. And if you want to see that in action, you already have it. So in the jam band community, right, the bands that take their inspiration from the Grateful Dead, these fans have been connected with each other for a long time. And, you know, the bands have set down some pretty clear guidelines regarding what the fans are allowed to share and what the fans are expected not to share. So, you know, the live recordings are shareable, but the studio recordings are not. And, you know, the fans, for the most part, respect these rules because they feel like there's some reciprocity. They feel like they're getting something out of it. The jam band communities basically run on these norms, and there's no reason these norms couldn't be exported to other musical communities as well. Now, do I think that the Britney Spears fans are ever going to behave this way? No, I don't, right? The disposable pop music in the moment is not going to run on this logic. But, you know, other types of music will, and I'm not sure, ultimately, I care that much about whether the disposable pop music of the moment is going to work as well under this new regime. As long as music as a whole works well under this new regime, I think I'm satisfied.
Chris, we're at the point in the show where I ask the unfair questions, because of the limited time we have left. And so let me, at the risk of pushing too hard, let me ask a slightly different, follow-up question. We know that there is no way empirically to establish what the optimum level of copying might be. Just as it's difficult or really impossible empirically to, say what the optimum level of IP is. When I teach IP survey, I say to my students, and I've yet to be disproved on this, that anyone that tells you what the optimum amount of IP is generally, is lying to you. Now, that I'm saying that generally in terms of a regime that covers everything. As you point out in your book, you have to think industry by industry. And in that sense, we might be able to be more fine-grained, but as far as one omnibus system, it's simply impossible. So if that is true, I'm curious to get your perspective on what industries still need or might still need a strong form of copyright. Are there examples of industries that you think could make a credible claim to saying that copying itself is not good?
Yeah, so I'll start with the pharmaceutical industry, right? So it's not so much copyright as patent, but the idea is basically the same. So pharmaceutical industry, the state of our science at the moment means that, you know, huge sums need to be invested in order to do drug research, then to finance the processes required to produce the compound once you've got it, to get it through the FDA approval process, to market it successfully, right? It's an enormously capital-intensive industry. And in that kind of environment, that is the strongest case for needing strong, enforceable property rights to make sure that competition from copyists does not interfere with the ability of the creator to get a return on that investment, right? So that's your kind of paradigmatic case. You know, most industries are more like fashion than they are like pharmaceutical. Music is much more like fashion than it is like pharma, motion pictures are kind of in between, right? So, but what's happening in motion pictures? Well, there's a couple of arguments. One is that production and distribution costs are getting cheaper in some of the ways that they got cheaper in music. And another argument is that, you know, the movie industry is just full of rent seeking. It's just full of people who get rents. Why does Tom Cruise get so much money per picture? Because he's living in an environment where those rents are possible. You remove the IP protection, you may not discourage the production of movies. It's just that, you know, the megastars may get paid less, which is not really a tragedy. You know, I do think that pharma is a great example of, you know, an industry that has a credible claim. I just don't think there are that many industries like pharma, frankly.
And so that leads us, and we have about 6 minutes left, and I do want to give time on this, because I know, and you talk about in the book, and the structure of the book is really interesting, because you go into these different industries, but you spend a good amount of time, synthesizing the case studies, if you will, that you cite towards a ladder, roughly, you know, a third of the book. And so, you know, again, I'll put you in the position of offering to members of Congress a view on what to do, if anything, on the infringement or piracy front. What would you want policymakers to take from this book? And I'll lead the question by saying this: is a message of the book literally to do nothing at all at the policy level? In other words, Congress leave industries generally alone.
I mean, the message of the book is that before Congress regulates, they should know something about the industries they're regulating.
Well, that might be helpful too, yeah.
It's a couple of times on the issue of whether they should extend copyright to cover the fashion industry. And my strongest memory of the first time I testified was all these Congress people, mostly men, but not entirely men, but asking a question of me and prefacing the question with some variation on the following disclaimer. I don't really know anything about the fashion industry, but, right? And at some point, I really wanted to say, look, you know, several of you have said to me, you don't know anything about the fashion industry. The fashion industry is worth $200 billion a year in the United States. Before you upend the regulatory structure of the fashion industry, maybe you should take the time to learn something about it, right? Stop listening to these 30,000-foot theoretical arguments about creativity and copying and incentives, and start thinking hard about how these things actually work out in the world. Because, you know, the theory that we talked about, that copying is hostile to creativity, that actually doesn't work very well in some very important creative sectors of the U.S. economy. That's the message. The message is that, you know, I mean, think about this for a moment. So Galileo was, you know, skeptical about a theory that had been around for a couple of thousand years by the time he got to it, that heavy objects fall faster than light ones, right? This is the Aristotelian theory of gravity, that heavy objects fall faster because they're attracted to the earth more, and so, you know, gravity is basically variable depending on the weight of the object. So Galileo climbs up a tower, he drops two different sized cannonballs off the tower, they hit the ground at roughly the same time. Aristotelian theory disproved, right? The theory sounded completely sensible, but when you went out to the world, it turns out that heavy objects and light ones fall at exactly the same rate.
And so that leads me, you know, it's a question that you've alluded to a few times, and again, we're in the unfair section. But I'm gonna ask you to take a step back and think about, or ask you a question with regard to the contribution that the book's making to scholarly literature. As you know, there is a regular push, at least in academic circles, to write theoretical articles. And I think you're making a strong case, and one with which I agree, that the theory only gets you so far, and at some point, you have to ultimately apply those theories in a way to move policy forward. And of course, you know, your critique of Congress with regard to fashion, the same can be said with regard to SOAP and PIPA, where you had members of the committees dealing with those issues saying, I don't know anything about how the internet works, which is a problem when you're going to change at least the rights and the structure of the internet potentially through law. What would you say to scholars writing in this area? Do you have a view of the relative contributions made by scholars generally on these issues today?
Yes. So Cal and I, back in 2006, shortly after we wrote the article on the fashion industry, we wrote this short essay which we called Where IP Isn't. And the essay was making a point about scholarship. So most IP scholars they're interested in IP, and so they look at industries where IP is. And that's why you had tons of articles on the music industry and tons of articles on the motion picture industry. They don't tend to look at places where IP isn't. And that's why when Cal and I got to the fashion industry, we found virtually nothing had been written on the fashion industry, despite the fact that the fashion industry is economically much more important than the music industry, right? So why is that? IP scholars like IP, and they want to study places where IP plays a role. They don't necessarily want to study places that aren't full of IP. But, you know, IP, frankly, isn't that important. What's important is creativity. And IP is only important if it's, you know, promoting creativity. What we should look at is places where creativity is, and, you know, maybe IP is there, maybe it isn't. Cal and I were interested in places where there's lots of creativity but not a lot of IP, because that helps tell the story about what IP does and what it doesn't do. So, you know, overall, I'm part of an IP scholarship community. I think they've done really important and interesting work. You know, I love being part of this community, and there's a lot of people in it I admire. But I think, you know, I will say that one contribution I think Cal and I have made to the literature is to say, you know, on a fundamental level, this literature shouldn't really be about IP law so much as it should be about creativity. If IP law has a role in fostering creativity in a particular setting, we should look at that very closely and describe it and understand it. If IP law has relatively little role in fostering creativity in a particular setting, we should look at that, understand it, and describe it. That's our job. You know, that's what I think my role is. And I do hope over time that the scholarship will trend in that direction. I think it'll be much, much more productive.
Professor Chris Sprigman of Virginia Law, a co-author of the book with Cal Rostigliola, The Knockoff Economy, How Imitation Sparks Innovation. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture, Chris. I always enjoy chatting with you, and this was no exception. Thank you for bringing these ideas to my listeners, and I appreciate you taking the time today.
Oh, Dave, I appreciate you having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Let me mention at this point a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture's schedule. I am in the process this week of putting together the final schedule for the quarter. And so literally this week I'm setting the schedule, but I can say this. Among the guests coming up this quarter will be Marcin D. Kaminski and Stefan Larsson of Lund University on Pirate Bay, as well as Professor Ann Balsamo of USC Annenberg School of Communication. Professor Shubha Ghosh, who has a new book out on patenting in the pharmaceutical industry, and a number of other guests as well. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback. And by the way, if you do have suggestions for guests for this quarter, now would be a good time to let me know. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a couple of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show live on KZSU's schedule. I am recording this show on Monday, October 1st. And as I sit here, I don't know when the show is going to air this week, other than to say that it will air this week. You can listen to it on KZSU's schedule, and you can get the schedule by going to kzsu.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to either the iTunes page for the Center for United Society at Stanford Law School, or by going to the webpage for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. I do want to make a special note here. A special thank you. Since the show began in May 2006, Joe Nito, who is the audiovisual person at Stanford Law School, has worked to make sure that the show posts on the servers at Stanford. And he did that work along with a pile of other work that he has from all of the productive scholars and entities at Stanford Law School. Joe is still at Stanford, but the responsibility of posting the show has now been handed over to Elaine Adolfo at CIS. And so I want to offer a special thank you to Joe for his work over the last 6-plus years in putting the show on the air, along with the multitude of other things that he has to do for Stanford Law. But his work in getting the show up is the reason why it's available as a podcast. And so I want to thank him on the show for the time that he took to do that work. I've worked with Elaine before. I look forward to working with Elaine, and thank Elaine in advance for the work she will do on that front, but a special note to Joe for doing all of this work over the last 6-plus years. I appreciate you listening to Hearsay Culture today. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.